MLK. And now, here's Jack Patty.
Good morning, News Talk 590 WBLK. Jack Patty is on vacation. My name is Scott Johnson. Glad you could be with us this morning for Forensic Friday on a 9 to 10 show brought to you by Landscaper's Corner, celebrating 10 years in business, your one-stop shop for all your landscaping needs. Landscaper's Corner, 1305 Old Frankfort Pike. Call 225-9433. Before we get into our topic this morning, let me give you our question of the day. We lighten it up for the weekend. So, the movie studios keep saying that they're not making as much money as they used to. So are you helping? Are you seeing movies in theaters more or less than in the past? We hear about everybody staying home and watching Netflix. Is that what you're doing? Give us your answer at WVLKAM.com. Cruiser will have the results for you between noon and 3 this afternoon here on News Talk 590 WVLK. Yesterday we asked how you felt about the Boston Marathon bomber's belated apology. 12% of you thought he was sincere, just too late. 15% thought he was insincere and playing for sympathy. 73% said, doesn't matter, sentenced to die, justice served, case closed. So, it is a Forensic Friday, and that means we have guests from the Commonwealth's Attorney's Office this morning. Andrea, I assume you're singing lead on this quartet.
I am. I'm substituting for Ray today.
All right. Andrea Williams is here, and I'll let you introduce the rest of our panel.
Scott, we have several people here with us today. We have Kathy Phillips, who's an assistant Commonwealth attorney here in our office and was lead prosecutor on this case. And then we have Sergeant Jeremiah Harville, who was the lead investigator on the case when it originally started. And then we have Detective Chris Rubsum, who I think took over a little bit for Jeremiah when he got promoted to sergeant.
All right. Gentlemen, welcome. I'm not sure if it's the first time you've both been in here. Okay, didn't think I recognized you. Kathy, it's been a while since you've been in.
A little while.
Yeah. So, welcome all. We're going to talk about a kidnapping case this morning. Where do we begin?
Well, I will introduce the case just briefly. The defendant's name is Perico Coffey. Kathy and Jeremiah, why don't you tell us how the police got involved in this case originally?
This happened in December of 2013. It was a late Monday night, early Tuesday morning, December 17th, police got a phone call of a woman that was totally nude, yelling for help on Bordeaux Drive on the west side of town, just off of Versailles Road. Police responded to the call that the woman at this time had been brought in by a neighbor who had let her into the house to seek shelter. She was totally nude, and the woman who let her in was scared because she had a gun and was saying that she had been kidnapped and raped. So police responded there. We were able to take the weapon and secure it, take the victim to the hospital to be checked out for injuries, and also to perform a sexual assault exam, as she had stated that she had been sexually assaulted over the past probably 45 minutes prior to her seeking help.
And Kathy, just can you explain, just so people know, what a sexual assault kit is and just truly how invasive that kit is, but how important it is.
Well, we have what is called a sexual assault nurse examiner, and she works with the investigators, but she is an actual nurse, and she does a very specific exam on every victim who has a sexual assault upon them. And so they're taken to the hospital, to a special area. It's a very special process using specialized equipment.
Sure.
So that they can do a very thorough exam and look for any type of physical injury that could have been caused from the assault, and also to collect evidence that will then be sent off for testing.
I suppose I need to ask Houlihan about this sometime, but my guess is that time is of the essence of getting this kind of evidence, and yet it couldn't come at a worse time emotionally for the victim.
Absolutely. I think that's right, Scott.
Well, it's a very invasive process, and this victim, like, we could use this case as an example. Here she's been through one of the most traumatic events, well, the most traumatic event in her life. She's being interviewed by multiple police officers. She's taken to the hospital. She's first given several interviews to different people along the way. She's sitting out there with a complete stranger, a patrol officer, and actually the patrol officer in this case was Officer Starkey. And, I mean, he still brings tears to my eyes when he talks about his interactions with her leading up to the exam. Then the detectives come in, and the detectives start doing this more thorough interview, which is long. And then they're taken into this room. They take off all their clothes and begin a very invasive physical exam that lasts for several hours. So it's incredibly, it's just another traumatizing event for the victim.
But time is of the essence for the collection of DNA, the injuries that are sustained during this type of sexual assault. That is of great essence that we get that that evidence. So, okay, Detective Harville, after you all have found her, what happens, and she goes to the hospital, and what happens at that point?
At that point, I did do an initial interview. We do an interview that's more comprehensive with the same examiner. However, with time being of the essence, this being a stranger, kidnapping, and assault, we needed to get as much information as quick as possible. So I'll kind of set up the scene of how we even got here. When I began to talk to her, she stated she had been with her sister in Lexington because she lives in Harrodsburg. She left her sister's apartment early hours of the morning, around 3 a.m. She was going to head home. She stopped at a ATM at the Versailles Road Speedway. There was a Chase ATM in there. She knew there was a Chase ATM there, wanted to get some gas, get some cash. So she goes in, she goes straight to the ATM, and she decides, I'm not going to get gas, I'm just going to go on home. So she immediately leaves. Well, while she leaves, the suspect in this case, Mr. Pericle Coffey, and this was seen on the surveillance video, follows her straight to her vehicle, pretty much had been casing her while she was in the store, him and two other gentlemen. As soon as she walks to her car, he follows her, puts a gun in her side, and says, move to the passenger seat and you may live. Doing whatever she can do for her life, she immediately moves over. He gets in, backs out of the parking spot, and takes off out of the speedway. She's in an area of town that she doesn't know very well. She's just doing whatever she has to do. He's making conversation with her. She said that it seemed like he was under the influence of something, the way that he was talking. It just wasn't usual, she would think, for somebody to be kidnapping her, and he's trying to make conversation with her. So she just kept the conversation going. He then drove to a secluded spot on Bordeaux Drive, and that's where he made her remove her clothes, made her perform oral sex, and continue to rape and sodomize her over the next 30, 40 minutes in her own vehicle. That's when, at some point, while he was performing the sexual assault, she was able to get the gun that he had put down, and she grabbed the gun and turned it on him and was able to get out of the vehicle. Once she was out of the vehicle, he continued to chase her for the gun, but he wouldn't get close enough because he was afraid she would fire. Mm-hmm. At this point, everybody's probably thinking, you know, why didn't you just shoot him? She was very emotional, and she said, number one, I didn't know if the gun would work. I've never shot a gun. If I pull the trigger and it doesn't work, I'm dead, because he's going to get it, and then he will know how to use it. And second of all, she said, in the back of her mind, I can't kill somebody. And she just kept running for her life, and he chased her around the car with her with the gun, and eventually she was able to get far enough away from him while he eventually got in her car and followed her while she's running until she found a house where a porch light came on, and then that's when he drove off with her car.
Wow.
And after he drove off, and this is a person that she did not know.
No, she had never seen this person. When she went into the Speedway, he was in there with two other gentlemen, and then they came outside and were waiting outside. She never paid any attention to him. So she never had seen him in her life, had no idea where this man had come from.
So when she talked to the police, she was able to give a description, and of course you all had the surveillance.
Correct.
Of what he looked like, but you didn't have any name or anything like that to go on.
Correct. She gave us a very good description, and we were able, Detective Rubes and I called him in to assist me. He got a hold of the surveillance video, was able to get some good caption shots of the video of the suspect. We were able to get that out to the news media and put that out. able to get that to the other officers in the police department. We immediately started receiving calls that they knew exactly who it was. That it was his face was plain as day.
All right, people knew who he was, and we will get on to the task of actually finding him and bringing him in when we come back from the break. It's Forensic Friday on News Talk 590 WVLK. Assistant Commonwealth Attorneys Andrea Williams and Kathy Phillips are with us, along with Sergeant Jeremiah Harville, Detective. We'll get to you before the show is over. If you've got questions or comments, please join us at 253-5959, star 590 on AT&T. Toll free, 877-777-0590. Or email, send it to the newsroom, news@wvlkam.com. I'm Scott Johnson in for Jack Patty here on News Talk 590 WVLK, where it is 918.
That he was going to be where there were some guns and drugs involved, and we coordinated with them, and we ended up getting his brother, but he had already left. So it was just a matter of using the tips that we got from the public, and we actually got a very good tip that he was leaving for Detroit, Michigan. And we were able to get the vehicle, and one of the guys that he was with that night that this crime was committed, we did get his friend, who was armed when we caught him as well, but evidently Mr. Coffey had already hit the road for Detroit.
And so how did they find him, Kathy? How did we find Mr. Coffey?
Well, I'll let Jeremiah talk about that because he was found in Detroit, correct?
That's correct. I had some witnesses that were giving me some information of some phone numbers he was possibly using, and we were able to coordinate with the marshals in Michigan and was able to locate him there using a phone number of a phone that he had borrowed and was posting Facebook messages with. So we were able to locate him there. Marshals picked him up and brought him back to Lexington in January.
So I guess one thing, just listening to this, it sounds like the cooperation of the public and witnesses in this case were really instrumental in locating him, identifying him, and getting him back to Kentucky.
Most definitely. If I hadn't received the tip about the phone number that we were able to trace from somebody in the public, it would have been a lot longer time of getting him, probably. Eventually, I'm sure he would have been brought to justice, but in that quick of a time span, less than a month from when this occurred, he was able to be taken into custody. And that's fairly quick, considering he was crossing state lines and hiding out with different family members and friends.
Well, and even though you knew where he was in general, you knew he was in the Detroit area, and as much as that city has lost, that's still a major city. It's a needle in a haystack kind of thing without those tips.
Correct. The information that we received from the public was vital in locating him as fast as we did.
Okay, Kathy, once he is extradited back to Kentucky, tell us about your trial preparation, and then let's talk about the trial in the case.
Well, on its face, this seems like it should be an easy case. I mean, it's incredibly violent, middle-of-the-night, stranger-type rape situation. In my experience, having done this 20 years, I knew that we had to expect everything. And immediately, Detective Harville started listening to the jail phone calls that this defendant was making. I met with the victim very early on with Detective Harville also. And I have to be honest, it's very difficult when you meet with the victim because, I mean, my heart goes out to her, and I believed her 100%, but I was already preparing for the defenses. And I knew what the defense would be. And the phone calls were already telling us he was going to claim she was a prostitute, he was going to claim he knew her, and he was going to claim that it was consensual sex. We always expect this in rape cases anymore. Even in this incredibly violent stranger situation, that story's going to come out by the time we get to trial a year later. So we have to start preparing for that. And from my very first meeting with the victim, I spent hours with her and just questioned her. I mean, not only about what happened to her, but still just trying to feel it out and make sure that we believed it,
right.
And we did believe it, but we're already kind of building the defense of her. The trial becomes about becoming her defense attorney when she's basically accused in trial of being a prostitute. And it's so unfortunate that it turns into that. And this poor, gosh, she was so strong. She's an amazing, amazing woman. And she did it. I mean, she dealt with us. She understood, and it didn't even show that it bothered her, but it had to. I mean, it had to bother her, but she was very, very strong and worked with us through that whole process.
So that's a common defense by the time someone gets to trial, that the lady is a prostitute or a stripper or what have you, and it's a consensual encounter.
Especially if they think the DNA is going to prove, if it's a whodunit, and they think there's DNA that's out there that's going to connect them, I always expect it to turn to consensual sex. She's a prostitute, or we've had a prior sexual relationship. And because there was so much contact between these two during the assault, I don't think anyone had any doubt there would be a DNA connection that would prove that he was in that car. Come to find out later on, after he already built up his consent defense, unfortunately, we didn't have any DNA really connecting him. But he had taken this approach, and so that's kind of the path the trial took.
So tell us a little bit about the trial itself.
Well, it went to trial pretty quickly. What happened was, so we already knew that this was going to pretty much be the defense from the jail phone calls that the detective had listened to. And then it started coming out during different court proceedings and when we would have evidentiary hearings. Evidence would be presented by the defense, already taking the angle or the path that it was a consensual sexual relationship. And during his presentation of his defense before trial, he let it be known through other witnesses and through the court proceedings that he claimed that there had been phone contact between the two of them, that she had called him or texted him beforehand and set this meeting up. And so he had these, and we have to provide the phone records. So we had subpoenaed all of her phone records and all of his phone records. So we're sitting here with just, I mean, volumes of phone records. And everyone texts and calls. And we had looked into every possible phone number to try to disprove that there was any contact between them. So they're saying there was contact. We're saying there wasn't. We have to give them all of those phone records before trial. So he had an opportunity to comb through those records and pick out one little phone number and claim that there was phone contact between them. It took us a while to kind of narrow down. We were going through every single phone call this poor girl made, every single text she made, asking her, who is this? Who is this? Why'd you call this person? Can we corroborate that you called this person and this isn't him? And just spent, I can't even tell you how many hours with her and going through these records. This became instrumental. Jeremiah had been promoted to sergeant, and Detective Chris Rupson, who is sitting back here, became my number one investigator on this and just poured over those records. I mean, we just spent days looking at those records trying to disprove that there was any contact between the defendant and the victim in this case.
That's got to be a job that requires pots of coffee to get through pouring over all of those records. Absolutely. I mean, I know it's got to be done, and it's something that you don't understand you've got to get to, but I would think that after about so many pages, your eyes would cross.
Sure, but it's definitely worth it when you have a victim.
All right. We're going to continue this story. We're a little late for the break now, but we will be back with Detective Chris Rupson, Sergeant Jeremiah Harville, Kathy Phillips, Andrea Williams from the Commonwealth Attorney's Office. And if you've got questions or comments, please join us at 253-5959. News Talk 590 WVLK. Scott Johnson in for Jack Patty on this Forensic Friday, and we have Andrea Williams and Kathy Phillips from the Commonwealth Attorney's Office, from Lexington Police, Detective Chris Rupson, Sergeant Jeremiah Harville. We're talking about the case against Perrico Coffee, the man accused of kidnapping and raping a woman. We have talked about the crime itself. We have talked about the efforts to find Mr. Coffee, and he was found in Detroit, brought back to Lexington for trial. Before the break, we started talking about the preparations for the trial. That's when we brought Detective Rupson in, talking about going through hundreds and thousands, I guess, of phone records, trying to make sure that the defense couldn't establish any kind of a prior relationship between these two.
And what was so difficult about these phone records is, upon initial review of the phone records, it looked like the victim was on the phone and texting during the time of the rape. We have this videotape, which gave us exact times. And then we have these phone records with exact times, and they weren't lining up. And we knew there was something wrong, but we couldn't figure out what it was. We're looking at the times, and they just didn't line up. But we knew she had been kidnapped and was abducted during this time. So this is why I think I drove everyone crazy, because I was like, we've got to figure this out. And thankfully, Chris did. Go ahead, Detective Ribson.
Right. Well, what we started to notice is that the times didn't match up, because one of the records came in, I believe that it was actual Eastern Standard Time, and another one came in at Greenwich Mean Time, which is actual time for London.
Right.
So we had to subtract that, plus taking into account the daylight savings time, and then things started to match up a little bit more.
Hmm.
Then also on the victim's phone, I believe, cell phone towers also lacked about an hour of difference there, but we got it all straightened out after comparing a couple of different cell phone records and taking in consideration the daylight savings time, all that good stuff. We got it all figured out, and it turned out that that number was dialed before the actual incident,
okay,
whatever the suspect's phone number he was using.
I remember it was a 550. He kept on saying that it was from 550. That was the number we were targeting. And so Detective Rubsum did additional investigation into that particular number and found that that number had been called to our jail and checked it against the jail phone call records recordings, checked those times, found out that the times on our cell phone records weren't correct by lining it up with the jail. We had charts,
wow,
we had diagrams.
That's just way too much math.
It was crazy, but he figured it out.
Amazing.
Okay, so Kathy, tell us a little bit about the trial, how it went, how many days it was.
Oh my goodness, it was a very emotional trial. It was long. There's such a weight to this type of situation because we knew so much was at stake. And this victim was just adorable. She's a wonderful person. She's a hard worker. She works in a nursing home. She's married. She lives out of town. Everything about her story, we just raked her over the coals. I mean, and she, like I said, she understood, but we had to do that to prepare. The rape itself, the sexual assault itself, the way she described it, the different things he did to her, was downright crazy. I mean, it was hard to believe. The first time I read the report, I had a hard time visualizing how this could have happened. And doing an opening statement and explaining it to the jury, and I was just looking at him going, please, you got to understand, you know, that this is still true, even though it sounds so crazy. But she was just so consistent from day one. Every little detail she described was just consistent all the way out. And by the end of the trial, there was just no question. I mean, how does someone do something like this? How does a rape victim act? And by the end, there was no doubt that that's how it happens, and that is what happened. It was just an incredibly violent, terrible sexual assault.
And Kathy, you just made an interesting point, I think. I think a lot of times people have in their mind how a rape victim is supposed to act, how they are supposed to look, or that sort of thing. But having done this, you said you've been doing this for 20 years, victims come in all shapes and sizes and handle the trauma to them very differently.
And even though we are trained and we have the experience, we still have expectations.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'll never forget the first time Jeremiah brought her in, Detective Harville, and I was just looking at her, and I was already judging her. And that's so unfair, even though I'm one of the biggest advocates there is for, I'm not going to say that, but I'm a very big advocate for these type of cases and these type of victims. And we should start out believing them. We should start out, we believe you, as opposed to questioning and trying to figure it out. But like I said, you know, we knew already in the beginning he was going to make her out to look like a prostitute. So our detectives, did a lot of work. We went to several strip clubs. Detective Rubson had to make several visits to different area establishments and check records. And The management was very cooperative with him on that. And you want to tell us a little bit about that, Detective Rubson?
Sure. I visit a lot of these establishments, usually off hours, so they weren't very active at that moment. But the management there was very cooperative, even though, to be honest, their record-keeping wasn't the most perfect. But they did, because I guess in that line of work, those people that work in those establishments travel a lot and go from establishment to establishment and try to be, as they said, quote unquote, the fresh face in town. Mm. So it was extremely difficult to try to go through some of those records to make sure that, you know, we could prove that she wasn't working at one of those establishments.
So I guess at some point he made some reference to her working in a gentleman's club here in town. Right. And then so you all went to a lot of these establishments to look through their records to determine that, in fact, she did not work.
Absolutely. He said that early on. Detective Harville was listening to the phone calls so that we could kind of figure out the angle they were taking. And early on, he was making references to strip clubs and her being a stripper.
Okay.
And him having prior contact with her. Right. So we turned to defend her on that.
One more break, and then we'll wrap this one up. 253-5959, star 590, AT&T, toll free 877-777-0590. If you would like to join us, I'm Scott Johnson on News Talk 590 WVLK. It is 947. That's us, News Talk 590 WVLK. Just about 8 minutes away from 10 o'clock, last segment of this Forensic Friday. Scott Johnson in for Jack Patty. Kathy Phillips and Andrea Williams from the Commonwealth Attorney's Office, Jeremiah Harville and Chris Rubson from Lexington Police are wrapping up the case against Perrico Coffee. Before the break, we were talking about the trial and the evidence that, you know, when we get into political arguments on this radio station, sooner or later, somebody jumps up and says, but you can't prove a negative. And yet that's what you guys have to do. As you were talking about finding some of this evidence and going through visiting the strip clubs and going through the fight, you're trying to prove negatives.
Absolutely. As I said, it became that we had to defend her, even though she had done absolutely mm-hmm. nothing wrong. She was in the wrong place at the wrong time, and that's all she did wrong. And that's not wrong, sorry. But anyway, so here we are going to trial, and of course, she testified, and it was very emotional, very long, very wearing for her and her family. And then we, of course, built our case. Then he testified. He stuck to his, quote, 550 number, and that's when all this phone investigation came in. We went after him. So he testifies. He actually put on witnesses to talk about him knowing her, mm-hmm. and people who came in and lied. And so then we put on our case about the phone records, and kind of the aha moment was, that's what Detective Rubson calls it, he figured it out, the phone number he was claiming that he called her from, the 550 number, first of all, wasn't at the right time when you got the correct times on the phone records, but we also were able to prove that that phone had been cut off, was not active on the day of the rape. It was a text that had been sent from that number, but she had never received it because that phone was cut off dead. And we brought in a witness from Ohio, I believe he was from, to testify about that those records. So at that moment, we all felt we felt relief because we felt like we were actually going to be able to do this and put this really bad guy away. The jury was not out very long at all, considering the nature of these charges and the amount of time involved. They came back and convicted him on absolutely everything. He was only 21 years old at the time of this crime. And then we had our sentencing hearing. We were out past midnight. The jury was out past midnight deciding the sentence in this incredibly grave case. And they came back with a recommendation of 46 years in prison.
Okay. We've just got a couple of minutes left. Something that been going through my mind that I want to ask about. First of all, some people that we haven't talked about here. On the night of the crime, you said that Mr. Coffey was with two other guys. What's the story with those two?
Well, those two decided that they did not want to divulge any information. They pretty much said that They had no knowledge of it, even though we had them on surveillance. They denied any knowledge of it. I mean, one of them was his brother. One of them was his friend that we arrested that was in possession of a firearm. But his claim was that they saw Perico walk away from the convenience store, and they never saw him again. So they never came in and testified in the case about what was going on that night. But just a little background of how they got there. They had all been to a gentleman's club on Alexandria Drive and made their way over to the convenience store after they had got kicked out. There was a group of about five or six of them. We determined that some of them were arrested that night for alcohol intoxication, and these were the three that didn't get arrested that ran from the police and ended up at the convenience store. So, in a way, it was an unfortunate event. Had we been able to get them earlier in the night, this might unfortunate event wouldn't have happened, and this woman wouldn't have had to suffer this.
Other person I wanted to ask about was the woman who helped the victim. Did she stay involved or in contact?
She was amazing. Okay. She was amazing. There were several neighbors who were incredibly touched by this. They came to the trial. They actually, after they were done testifying and allowed to sit in the audience, sat in the audience and watched his support. They were able to describe, because one of the crazy things about this case was she's running up and down the street naked and screaming, and nobody comes out to help. And this is a nice neighborhood. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is a place where people would help. But we worked with them. We went out there. We looked at the lawns. We looked at the fences. And when you really got down to it, there was no place for her to go. All these houses are fairly close to each other, and they almost all have fences connecting them to each other. And they were very supportive and very helpful throughout the whole process.
As quickly as you can, because we just have less than a minute, tips for people to avoid becoming victims in a situation like this.
Wow. Unfortunately, you never know when something like this could happen. But obviously, if you're going to be out late at night, let somebody know where you're going, when your estimated time is to be there. If you're going to go pump gas, make a phone call to somebody, talk to them while you're doing it, and always be aware of your surroundings. You know, if something looks out of the ordinary, in this situation, you should let the cashier know. You walk me out to my car, just simple things like that, and just being aware of your surroundings and letting people know where you are.
All right. Folks, thank you so much. Kathy Phillips, Andrea Williams from the Commonwealth's Attorney's Office, Sergeant Harville and Detective Rubson from Lexington Police, we appreciate you coming in this morning. And as always, everybody, thanks for listening.